Good evening. This is Jeff Sachs of Web Yeshiva, and we are learning Masechet Ta'anit from Beit Knesset Mishkan Tzipora in Efrat. We are on Daf Kaf Aleph Omud Beis 21b. Last week we ended with these stories of these two incidences of apparent salvation in the town of Rav and in the town of Rav Huna. And the Gemara said, but you know, don't think the salvation came about because of the merits of Rav and Rav Huna, who, after all, are too great to be concerned with such a small matter, to waste their merits in such a small matter. I assume the Gemara there is being ironic, right? Because the point of the Gemara, like on the surface of it, it seems rather odd. Like, what does that mean? In other words, there's a fire, the whole town burns down, or there's a dever, there's a plague affecting the whole town. But in their neighborhoods, in the neighborhood of Rav and Rav Huna, they weren't affected. And the Gemara kind of dismisses, don't think this was on account of Rav or Rav Huna, you know, who couldn't get involved in such small matters. And in fact, I really believe the Gemara has to be ironic. I thought about this after we left last week. The Gemara is clearly being ironic. Because what's the point of the Gemara? That it's dafka the small people, right? It's dafka the old lady who used to light her stove in order to make sure her neighbors always had a place to cook their food Oh, and then the fellow who would lend out his tools in order to go and in order to help the burial society, right? He'd lend out his shovel, his pickaxe, so that the burial society could bury the dead. Now, these simple acts of human kindness, the Gemara is being ironic when we talk about who's a great man and who's a small man, right? That sometimes it's the small kindnesses of daily life which are really what sustains a society. I think that's clearly the point. The Gemara now goes on. We were talking earlier about when Dever comes to the world, and now we'll talk about a different plague, the plague of locusts. Omru lei l'Rav Yehuda. They tell Rav Yehuda, Atu kamtse, locusts have been spotted in town. Gezar ta'anita. So he declared a fast. He was fast to declare a fast. So Amrule, loka mafsidan. Don't be so hasty. They're not destroying anything yet, right? And it's just, we saw locusts, right? But it's not like they've devoured the crops and doing those other things. I think a couple of weeks ago, didn't I show a video of the locusts? Yeah, so I didn't want to show it again. But you saw how they come. They just, like a vacuum cleaner, they suck everything up. So in other words, they say, hey, we saw locusts. So he immediately snaps to action and he declares a fast. Remember, when we were learning about Dever last week, there was a kind of calculus the Lishchat Ochlusin, of the population statistics, of how many people have to die in how many consecutive days within a population of how many people in order to say, you know, something's going on here. Yeah, on any given day, somebody dies. That's not a sign that there's a plague going on. But here, a locust shows up and he immediately declares a fast. And they say, wait a second, don't be so hasty. The locusts aren't eating anything yet. So Amar Luhu, he said to them, Zavda Aita Bahadaihu? Did they bring a mizvada? Right? Did they bring a picnic basket? In other words, the locusts show up. What do we know about locusts? They devour everything. And then, having devoured everything, they lay gazillion eggs that hatch into even more hungry locusts. So I should wait until they've finished eating? What, do you think they brought their own bag lunch? No. They're going to eat our food. So we're going to snap into action now. Now, of course, our snapping into action is fasting, which seems a little odd. In other words, we're about, what's the problem of the locusts? They eat all the food. If they eat all the food, we don't have anything for ourselves. So the solution is to fast. But we should tell everybody to eat twice. So fasting, of course, is not about the intake of food or the not intake of food. It's about tshuva, because the arrival of the locusts are seen as a form of divine punishment. So Omrulei l'Rav Yehuda, Ika motna b'chazire. There's a plague among the pigs. The pigs are dying of some kind of pig plague. Gazarta anita. He made a fast. Why? Rav Yehuda was so compassionate to the lives of the pigs. He didn't want to see any pigs die. You know pigs? They're not so kosher. You know, if you go to the zoo in Yerushalayim, they have that sign near the, you know, the peccaries. Peccary is a kind of animal, which is clearly somehow related to pigs. But it says in Yiddish, "Dos is nishta ka chazer." This is not a pig. Because the Charedim thought it was a pig, and they got very upset. So we had to tell them, "Dos is nishta chazer. This is not a pig. Don't be confused. It's just it's a different non-kosher animal. A peccary is no more kosher than a pig. But about the pigs, there's a, you know, pigs are the central casting choice for non-kosher animal. And there are all types of other taboo around pigs that you don't have around.
It is the biblical zoo, and pigs are mentioned in the Bible. I mean, why?
Yeah, no, because there's this prohibition against raising pigs in Eretz Yisrael.
It's funny, when they had the swine flu, which I guess maybe this is talking about something similar.
Oh, David, since you prepared ahead, you know full well that's what we're about to get to.
So, well, we're talking about the plague of pigs. So they, if you recall, the Haredi outlets would not refer to it as Shabbat Chazirim. They called it Shabbat Mexico.
Oh.
Because that's where it came from. So I made a thing where I basically replaced the words. I put up a little thing where you took the words of Chazir in the Torah and I replaced it with the word Mexico. Like, you know, you can't mention the word.
Well, you know, the Gemara says, Asula Adam lahotzi davar migune mitoch piv. You can't. We were talking about Rav Aaron Soloveitchik the other day. There's a family, there's a rather well-known YU family whose last name is Bacon. B-A-C-O-N. They're actually related to Nomi Berman, our neighbor, Todd Nomi Berman. I think Nomi's a cousin. I forget how. The dean of Stern College is a woman named Dr. Karen Bacon, who's married into the family. Her father-in-law, I believe, was many years ago, was the dean of Yeshiva College. Dean Bacon, the famous Dean Bacon. So Rav Aaron Soloveitchik would say Beckon with a segol instead of a tsere. And he apparently once tried to explain why grammatically it's more correct not to have a bet tsruya, the beginning of a word, instead you have a bet segula, to say Beckon instead of bacon. And he said, and anyway, I mean, you know, asur la'adam lahotzi davar megune mitoch piv. You can't say the word chazerfleisch, right? It's not a halacha, but it's a taboo.
Are nightingales a kosher bird?
Nightingales are not a kosher bird, but it's a good question you ask. There's a story. If I've gotten off track already, I might as well tell the story. That great man, Rav Wolgelanter, Dr. Maurice Wolgelanter, was a professor. He was a rabbi. He was a rabbi in a shul in Manhattan, and he taught English literature in Yeshiva College. I had him for two semesters, and I also had a chavrusa with him. He would sometimes learn with guys in the Beis Medrash. I learned the Hagos Hagro on the Beir Hagro on the Shulchan Aruch with him. I actually just wrote something on the tradition website where I cited something he said Emerson, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Emerson's essay on self-reliance. So he and Dean Bacon did not get along at all. So there's this famous story. I heard it from Shalom Carmi, who says it was his first class of his first day his first class of his first day of his first semester of college. And Vogelanter comes in. Vogelanter was called the Reb. Everyone called him the Reb. And he had just had a fight with Dean Bacon. And he comes into class and he introduces himself to his, you know, freshman English 101. He says, "My name is not Hammy. My name is not Porky. My name is not Chazer." Every synonym for pig, every synonym for bacon you can think of. He says, "My name is Vogelanter." And he writes Vogelanter on the board. He opens up the door to the classroom, screams down towards the dean's office, "You hear that, you hammy son of a gun?" So, anyway, bacon. Bacon. So there's a swine flu. There's something going on. The pigs are dying. So if Yehuda makes a fast, Gazar Ta'anita, Neima Kasavar of Yehuda, Maka Mishulachat Mimin Echad, Mishulachat Mikol Aminim. Does this mean that Rav Yehuda holds, he was paskining a biology question? He didn't turn to Fox News for his understanding of how infection works, how vaccines work, or not, right? Does this mean he had a position that if a disease is affecting one species, it can jump to another species? Lo, he did not believe that, but he did believe shani chazire didamian ma'ayhu livnei inshi. He did believe that you could have cross species infection from swine to humans. In other words, he understood that there was such a thing as what we call the swine flu, right? That it can make that, it can make that jump. So now this is, of course, a really interesting, this is an interesting question. I just want to draw your attention to, hold on, I'm trying to share my web. No. Oh, here. How do I move this? Here. So this is a website called Talmudology. Talmudology.com. It's a, you see it on the screen?
I don't see it.
Oh, hold on.
It's the move.
No. I had paused my Zoom. Okay. Now you see it?
Yeah.
Right. This is a website called Talmudology. It's written by Jeremy Brown, who used to live in Efrat. He's married to Dr. Erica Brown. So Jeremy is an emergency room physician and a Talmud Chacham, a Lamdan. And he writes this blog. At the beginning, he started doing it, I think, at the beginning of the, you know, the current cycle of Daf Yomi. I think he used to blog a little more frequently, but whenever there's anything, he doesn't do it every day. He's not like that TikTok woman that everybody read about this week. Whenever there's something science related on the DAF, he generally tries to post about it. So it's worth taking a look at Talmudology to our DAF. So he mentions that the Gemara is talking. He also wrote a book. Fortunately, he wrote it before Corona. On the eve of Corona, he wrote a book on the 100th anniversary of the 1918 influenza, about, you know, how the Spanish flu started and spread, and it's how it was treated and other things. A very interesting book, which was overlooked, but now he's coming out with a new book about pandemics. You know, suddenly the topic that nobody was interested in reading about is much more relevant. So on today's page of Talmud is the discussion about the pandemics, but it's not about human pandemics, it's about pig pandemics. So then he quotes our Gemara, and he mentions this, he discusses this idea of cross-species infection. And, you know, he explains that that's clearly, I mean, this was written... When was this written? This was written before Corona started? I don't know. Is there a date on this?
The date looks like December of 2021.
Oh, so it was a document. Yeah, so this was after the Corona started. And Corona certainly, we know, is you know, probably originated in some species in China. But then he has this really interesting tefillah that... Yes.
Yeah. Oh, it took me 17 minutes to connect.
Okay.
Were you living in the USA when the swine flu business took place in 1975 and 1976?
I was a little kid. Yeah, I remember it.
Okay. Well, that the reason why everybody got immunized or vaccinated at that time was because everybody felt the CDC strongly recommended that because the swine flu was going to go into people from pigs.
Yeah.
And the only thing that stopped it was the fact that about several people who got the vaccine developed Guillain-Barré syndrome. So the result of that was that the whole, but by that time, about 70 million people had been immunized, right, including yours truly. And but there was no question that swine flu can spread to humans.
Yeah.
So,
no. So obviously, but no, that's the point that Rav Yehuda, we didn't need the Ford administration to tell us that Rav Yehuda already knew that swine flu can spread to humans, which is why when the swine started dying, he instituted a fast because he understood this was potentially dangerous for humanity. But anyway, but then Jeremy here has something that was found in the Library of Congress collection. It's a Pashkevil. It's a broadside, which is a tefillah lahashpit hanegev shechel bevehemot sadai. Right? In other words, there was a tefillah that was composed if there was some kind of dever affecting the cattle or the pigs or whatever it is, because there was this understanding. It's not just financial. Certainly if the pigs are dying, it doesn't affect the Jewish parnasa. Right, but it's potentially dangerous to all people. So anyway, I'll put this in the chat. Is a link to the call.
It's interesting that today we take heart valves from pigs, yeah, and transplant them into humans.
Right. But here, Rav Yehuda, and as it's also clear that Chazal had a working knowledge of anatomy. You know, whether that was knowledge that was gained from, you know, secondhand from, you know, the larger culture, right? As Chazal understood that pig anatomy bears certain resemblance to human anatomy. Now, of course, there's also, like, you can Google it. I won't share it now. But, you know, you can Google it to find out how closely related or how much DNA overlap there is between humans and any other species.
98%.
With chimpanzees.
Pigs.
With pigs. So I see here, what do I see? So pigs.
Google.
Right. So chimps are 98.8, gorillas are 98.4, and pigs are 98%. But we have more DNA in common with pigs than we have with orangutans. Quite surprisingly, we have 90% overlap with cats and 85% with mice and only 84% with dogs. So when we talk about dogs being our best friend, it doesn't mean we're the most closely related. Most interestingly, we have 60% DNA in common with bananas. I don't know what that means. But the point is that
98% for it to be considered a problem.
Yeah. Anyway, the point is that Chazal were aware of this. The cross species transplants, the transplant of human pig heart valves. Have they not done? Why don't they do that with like chimpanzee hearts? Are they not compatible?
Much harder to find, I imagine.
I don't know, I guess. I mean, it's easier to get a pig heart than it is to get a chimpanzee heart, but
I think also...
I think it's more than just the physical anatomical aspect.
Yeah.
I think they say that pig's milk is close to human milk.
Oh, really?
Well, it's nothing to do with the anatomy, is it? It's the, I don't know what you call it, epidemiology or something like that.
I guess, I don't know. Anyway,
I believe insulin for diabetics, I don't know if it still is, but was from pig.
From pig? Mm. Okay, so anyway, but the point here is that, you know, the death of the pigs, since it's potentially dangerous, so then you start fasting. Not because we're davening for the pigs, per se, but because of the it was understood that there was a danger to humans, that the plague could spread to humans. So Amru le Shmuel, they tell Shmuel, Ika motna bechozai. In this place bechozai, there was people were dying of some kind of disease. Gazar ta'anita, he decreed a fast. Omar le vaha mirachik, but it's far away. Right? In other words, Shmuel was in where?
Arda.
Right, where's Beit Chozai? Somewhere else. In other words, they report to him that in this other town, some distance, right, there was a plague. So here in Nahardo, he made a fast. Omar, Leika, Ma'abra, Omar Leika Mabra Hacha de Posikle. So he says there's no machsom. There's no machsom that will stop it. In other words, it's not like we could put up like this whole idea of what we've been going through these last 2 years, the idea that it could all be contained, the idea that we can keep the COVID in a bubble, like we see how permeable it is. You can do things to like knock the statistics down a little bit, but the idea that you can and Shmuel was talking long before you had international air travel, right? He says there's no machsom, there's no machsom?
Barrier,
right? There's no what do you call that thing that comes down, you know, that we have at the that arm, that electric arm. Well, you know what I mean. There's no machsom that will stop it. So if they have it there, it'll get to here. So Amr Leila Rav Nachman, Ika Motna Ba'arad Yisrael. They report that there was some kind of plague going on in Eretz Yisrael. As they report in Bavel that in Eretz Yisrael there was a plague. So Gazar Ta'anita, he makes a fast. Omar Im Gvira Loka Shifchalo Kol Shekein. If the mistress of the house, if the queen in the palace is afflicted, the lowly servant won't be afflicted. In other words, there apparently fasting is not because we're afraid that the disease is going to travel all the way from Eretz Yisrael to Bavel. Right? In fact, that may have been unlikely, because anybody carrying the disease, you know, if it's a deadly disease, anybody carrying the disease would have been dead before they could bring it to Bavel. So why fast? Because there, it's not fasting because we have to do tshuva so that we won't be afflicted. We have to fast because we are in solidarity with the queen in the castle, with the gvira, with Eretz Yisrael. If there's a plague in Eretz Yisrael, it affects Jews b'chol atar v'atar. Right, that has always been our attitude wherever we were in the diaspora. Ta'ama de gvira.
Did they do it for drought? I don't recall. I know we had times we've instituted the tefillah. I don't remember that was required to do it in the chutzaretz as well. Has that been something?
I don't know. This is a kind of ad hoc thing. I don't know that he's establishing the halacha per se, but this is what he did. Right, this is what he did. So ta'ama de gvira v'shifchas. Now the Gemara kind of like tries to analyze this metaphor of Eretz Yisrael is the gvira, the high noble lady, and Chutz La'aretz is the Shifcha, the lowly servant girl. Ha Shifcha v'Shifcha. But wait a second. Right? In other words, the reason that Rav Nachman said you have to fast if there's something going on in Eretz Yisrael, that's because of the noble woman and the servant girl. Right? But what about a case of two cities in the diaspora, of a Shifcha and a Shifcha, two servants, right? In other words, Surah and Nahardo are both spiritually on the same level. Right? So does that mean that if there's a plague in Surah, they wouldn't fast in Nahada, and vice versa? If there's a plague in Germany, Spanish Jewry shouldn't fast? V'ha omru leila Shmuel, ika motna bechozai gazar tanita. After all, Shmuel had said that in Nahada we fast, even though there's a plague far away. Shani hatam, kevan de'ika shayarta de'livu v'atya bahadya. In Shmuel's case, even though it was a case of two of a shifcha and a shifcha, right? He fasted for the place that was remote because there was trade between the two places. There were caravans that would go back and forth. And he understood that once the disease was there, it would get to us. Remember in those early days of Corona? Like, you know, you heard that there was this thing going on in China. So we didn't pay too much attention to it. Like with SARS. Remember SARS? I remember, how long ago was that SARS thing?
I think it was about 2003.
Yeah. So I remember I was going to America and I landed, you know, that flight that lands like 5 a.m. in Kennedy? And, you know, it's like there's nobody there in the airport at that time. But there was some flight coming in from China at the same time. So it was all of us, mostly Yidden coming from Eretz Yisrael, and mostly Asians coming from China. And the Asians are coming, all the people coming off the flight from China were wearing the masks, which I had never seen. And I thought, like, what? They look so stupid. Why would anybody walk around with a mask like that? Right, I quit. Right, in other words, it's like such a different world, right? But with COVID, it was like just like at a certain point, there was like that sense of like it's just a question of time until you get it. When will the first case be identified?
I was flying in America in February of 2020, I was in Seattle. I was in San Francisco, and there were a lot of flights coming in, and again, but then they sort of knew what was going on. It was only a few weeks until they hit us as well.
So he says there, if you know that they're going to be coming back and forth, he says we know that it's gonna get us. Okay, so now the Gemara brings a different case. This seems to be connected to everything we were doing now about the locusts, and from the beginning until now, seems to be parenthetical, because now I think the Gemara is going back to last week's topic, which I reviewed by way of opening now, that of the merits of the simple person, the woman who heats her stove, the man who lends out his shovel. Abba umanahava. There was Abba, an Oman is a blood letter. Right? In other words, it was a miktsoa, it was a job to be a bloodletter. Right? People used to have their blood let frequently. For a long time in Europe, barbers doubled as bloodletters. Right? You know, that's what, you know, like the barber pole with the red, right? That might be like the international sign of being a bloodletter. I mean, it might have been because they were like the barbershop and the bloodletter, like, you know, it was a place you'd sit down, you'd lay back. They'd cut your hair, they'd open a vein, they'd let out the blood. You know, it was a place that usually had ready access to sharp tools. I don't know, like, why these two things went together. I think didn't bloodletting have a kind of renaissance a couple of years ago? Like all these Mishigas fads that come and go. So he was a bloodletter was a kind of paramedic. Right, it was like a low level. It wasn't a doctor, But people went to, you know, particularly if your humors were out of balance and there weren't too many, you know, medical procedures that were available even to the greatest doctors relative to what our people have today. Going to the bloodletter was going for a medical procedure. So Abba Umana Hava Ate Le Shlama Mimetifta Direkia Kol Yoma. Every single day, this Abba, the bloodletter, would get a message, would get Shalom Aleichem from the Metifta Direkia, from the Yeshiva Shel Mala. What does this mean? I don't know. Perhaps it means he was on a very close connection with God. Every day, Hashem would say to him, Shalom Aleichem, Abba, the bloodletter. Abaye kol mala yoma de shabta. But Abaye would only receive such a kind of divine high five once a week on Erev Shabbos. Larava kol mala yoma de kippura. And Rava would only get the message once a year on Erev Yom Kippur. So in other words, you have this simple guy, you know, to be the bloodletter is not exactly like being the Rosh Yeshiva. He was getting some kind of bat kol or some kind of divine message every day, when Rav and Abaye were getting at most once a week or once a year. So havaka chalsha date da Abaye, mishum da Abba umana. Abaye was like a little disturbed by this. Like, why is this simple guy on such a high connection with the divine, you know, greater than me? So Amr le, lo matzit le ma'aved ke'uvade. Well, the response was, it's not clear who is telling Abaye this, but the answer to Abaye is that you can't do what he's able to do, meaning his merits are greater than yours. Uma hava uvade da Abaye umana? And what were these great acts of the bloodletter? Dechihava oved milta, hava machet gavre lechud neshay lechud. He was makbid to keep the men and women separate. But when the men and women would come for their procedures, he wouldn't let them mix. Because, you know, you'd have to get undressed, you'd have to, you know, it wasn't necessarily the most tsanua thing. He kept his practice, you know, to be, you know, pretty straight. I used to go to a dermatologist. I switched dermatologists. I used to go to a dermatologist that had a big Haredi clientele. So, like, in the waiting room, I mean, I stopped going to him because he could never keep the appointments straight. Like, no matter what time your appointment was, you'd wait an hour and a half. It was terrible. So there was always a lot of people in the waiting room. But they'd try to keep the separate seating in the waiting room. That's not what bothered me. But I thought it was curious. You know, dermatologists, it's like... What?
No, when I read this, that's exactly what I thought it meant. That he kept them separate in a waiting room, speaking from one dermatologist to another.
Yeah. So, but it was a funny thing, the waiting room of the dermatologist, because, you know, half the people are there because they suspect they have melanoma and they're going to be, you know, in a really bad way. And the other half of the people in the waiting room are these Beis Yaakov girls that are getting ready to go on a shidduch date and they woke up with a pimple. Right? In other words, very different kinds of experiences going on in the same waiting room. Anyway, so he was makbid, whatever it is, he was makbid on the tsniut of this place that people were coming where potentially it could be very unsanua. V'it le levusha de'it be karna de'havat bzia ki kosilta. And he would have the women would wear a certain kind of medical gown that had instead of basically telling them, okay, take off your clothing and lay on the table, he kept them covered, and this gown had some kind of opening in it where he could insert the scalpel to where he needed to get to, so that he was able to preserve their they're, you know, it's, I mean, this is true. Like, you know, you go to a doctor, you know, there's some doctors that they look at you like you're a piece of flesh. And
yeah, other... but what counts a routine? There's no such thing as walking into a room with a female patient, you know, who is going to have to in some way disrobe. Then your first thing you do is you have your nurse hand her a gown. You go out of the room, and right. When she's ready, then you go back in.
Yeah,
that's
but
routine today.
That's today. That's today. But was that true? Was that true? Was that true 50 years ago?
It was true as remember as long as I remember.
How long are you practicing medicine?
When I was in medical school, I'll tell you that. That was more than 50 years ago.
Anyway, the point is that whatever he did to maximize the dignity of the patient, and not to both for tzniut and also I think for the dignity of it. You know, these things can be very undignified. They can be very demeaning to the patient if the procedure is not carried out with a sensitivity. Ki havet atyale itata, when a woman would come to see him, have a malbishlo ki hechidolo nis. Nistakelbo, right? He would only uncover the parts that needed to be seen. He didn't, you know, make her stand there in the nude. Ve'itle duchte de tsnia de shade be pshita de shokil. And he also had a place, the payment system was done in such a way where it was done kind of anonymously. I mean, there was no Medicare, Medicaid, but there was a hidden spot where the people that were coming for their treatments would put their pshite, their coins, right, to pay him. So that de'itle shode be, de'itle lo michsaf. People that could afford to pay him would pay him, you know, anonymously through this slot in the wall. And if a person couldn't pay, they weren't embarrassed. Right? These were the... these were the traits of Abba the bloodletter. Ki hava it ramele tsuba mirabanan, and when he was doing bloodletting on tsuba mirabanan, on talmidei chachamim, on yeshiva students, agra mine lo shokil, he wouldn't charge them.
Did they dress differently?
Did they?
How would he know if it's
I don't know. How do you know? You know, a student comes in and you say, "How are you today, sir?" I mean, first of all, you know, like the barber like knows his clientele. You know who's who.
Everybody has to come to their office for the first time, and then, you know.
So you talk. I don't know. On the form, on the intake form, it asks, "What's your profession?" If they're right, yeshiva student, you know, I don't know. He had a way of knowing who was who. Think of like small town, you know, like every depiction of like a small town doctor, right? You know, he knows everyone in town, you know, like the doctor in Mayberry knew who was who. Uvatar Dekai, and when they would get up to leave, Yohav Le Pshite V'Amar Le Zil Bri Nafshecha. Now it's not only that, but when they were leaving, he would give them lunch money. He would say, "Go and eat something, bri nafshecha, go heal yourself." Right? Now, this is not physician heal thyself; it's, you know, patient heal thyself. Yom echad shada, and it's because the yeshiva students, they were always hungry. They were always they didn't have money, so he would slip them a little what my grandmother would call traveling money, to go and buy himself a sandwich or something on the way out. Yom echad shoder abaye zuga derabanan lemivdeko. So, because of this, you know, the stories of this Abba, the bloodletter, who, to be clear, there are no wonder stories here. You know, this isn't the case that the building is going to fall down except for the fact that he's present. These are all very human stories. By the way, just like people that we know. I mean, everybody's heard stories of people that are, you know, very generous and always helping out. There was a story just the other week on This American Life about a doctor. David, you still listen to This American Life?
Not every episode, but I've heard some.
So there was a story about a doctor who was, you know, like a doctor in a small town who, you know, never didn't charge patients who couldn't pay and was very selfless and was running around doing house calls in this day and age and etc. Right? So Abaye says, "Oh, I hear that this guy, he's really, I can maybe understand why Hashem talks to him every day and not to me." So he sends a pair of Rabbonon to go check this out with their own eyes. Otvinhu, Vachlinhu, Vashkinhu, he sits them down and he gives them a meal and he gives them what to drink. Umachluhu bistarke belela. And at night he puts out a mattress for them. He puts out a mat, a rug on which for them to sleep. The top of Daf Kof Bet Omer Aleph. Letzafra, I mean, it was all a setup. It was all some kind of test to see, you know, to see this person's mettle. Letzafra.
How do we know that he got these messages from heaven every day?
I don't know. The Gemara doesn't say. Perhaps in the Mephoshim there's some kind of explanation of what this, we don't even know what these messages are, right? But whatever it is, it's some kind of sense that he was on a very high spiritual level. You don't have to interpret it more deeply than that, right? Abaye knew that this guy was a tzaddik bigger than him. So how is he such a tzaddik, right? I'm Abaye, right? I'm Abaye. I'm the backbone of the whole Torah Shebal Peh. And here's a guy. He's a bloodletter, right? He's a, it's like saying he's a, I don't know what would be the equivalent today.
Is it permissible to offer tzedakah to somebody who hasn't asked for it? Because that's what this story is saying. It seems to me, if I haven't tried to do that in my office, the person will be insulted. What do you think I am, a charity case?
No. In other words, I think apparent. In other words, the people that he was not. First of all, no, he's doing two different things. One is it was a kind of pay as you can system, right? Maybe there was a sign that said what the recommended payment was, but then it said pay whatever you can. And everybody was able to pay or not pay or to leave. And somehow either he had independent wealth or he had enough parnasa because he was good enough and the people that could pay would pay, that he was able to be flexible with his billing. My father-in-law, Zichrono,
the prophet's bothering me is that he offers money to people who haven't even requested it.
No, he offers it. Yeah. In other words, hungry yeshiva students, right?
How does he know that they're hungry?
Because they're yeshiva students. The definition of a yeshiva student is you're always hungry. Right? That's the definition of being in yeshivas. You're always hungry. The food is no good. Right?
I had no end of yeshiva students' patience in Brooklyn. And if you ever try to give them money and they didn't ask for it,
okay. Things at times are different. I don't know, but you can imagine. Forget about in Bovel in the third century, in Volozhin in the 19th century. If you read any of the memoirs of life in the Yeshivot Lita. It all describes them as always being freezing and always being starving. So anyway, the point is he was generous. He would say, "Here, take a go get a sandwich," right? He was like a Yiddish mama, right? He was like a Yiddish mama. So Abaye sends these two. They're not exactly spies, but they send them to go check it out. So they get there, and he gives them a place to he gives them to eat and to drink and to sleep. Olat Safra, this is the top of the Gemara, Karchinhu Vishaklinhu. In the morning, they roll up these mats that they were given to sleep on, and they leave. They take them with them. They bet some, they steal them. Vakamu, Venafku Lahu Lashuka, and they take them to the Shuk. Vashkachinhu, and they bump into him in the Shuk, and they're holding these mats. Now, the Gemara here is a little hard to understand. Like, just to understand the plot of the story. But Amrulay, they say to him, L'shame mar hechishavu. Can you give us an estimate of what these are worth? In other words, it's his property. And they're saying, what would you pay for this? In other words, like somebody steals from you. And you catch them red-handed in the shuk, trying to sell it. And they're trying to sell it back to you. Amr lehu, hachi v'hachi, kach v'kach, this is how much it's worth. Amru lei, v'dilma shavu tfei, maybe they're worth more than that. And he says, Amr lehu, b'hachi shaklinu. No, that's exactly what I paid for it, because they're mine. I know, I have the receipt right here. Amru lei, didachnihu, v'shaklinu minach. They admit they are, in fact, these rugs are, in fact, yours, and he takes them from him. So they say to him, Omrule, they say to him, B'matuta minoch. What are you thinking? Please, B'vakasha, B'mai chashadtinan. What do you suspect us of? They say, okay, now what do you think? Let's put you to the test. In other words, they set him up. It's very difficult to understand how they could have done this, particularly as agents of Abaye. They go to his house. They benefit from his charity. In the morning, they steal from him. It's like, you know, it's like, it's both like the story of, well, not exactly, of Yosef putting the gvi'ah into the bag, but it's also like in Les Miserables, right? When he goes to the priest, and in the morning he steals the silver. He's a redeemed man. He comes out, and he goes to the priest, and the priest takes him in, he gives him food and drink, and tells him you could change your life. And he steals the candlesticks. So they kind of set him up. They go to his house, they take his hospitality, they steal from him, and then they arrange a meeting with him where they're trying to sell it back to him, and they're trying to say, you should pay for more than... And he doesn't say a word. And they say to him, okay, mister, like, what do you think? What do you suspect us of? Omer lehu, amina, pidyon shvuyim, ikle lehu l'rabonu. When I saw that you had taken these things from my house, I assumed that you were presented with an opportunity to redeem some captive, and you needed money, you know, for capital, for ready cash, in order to do the great mitzvah pidyon shvuyim, and that's the reason you took it. Ve'ichsifu lemei marli, and you were embarrassed to mention it to me, or you neglected to mention it to me. Omrulei hashta nishklinu mar. So they say to him, now we'll explain it to the master. Right? Omar lehu mehahu shata. No, and now we'll return. Now we will return the rugs to you. Omar lehu mehahu shata asachtinhu medate letzdoka. So he says, no, I won't take the rugs back, because from the moment that I assumed that you had taken the rugs because you needed to sell them in order to get money, in order to redeem a captive Jew, I was mafkir, right? I had yehud. I assumed that you had taken them for that good reason, and I had hesechadat. I presumed that the cost of giving up my rugs would be accounted for me as a tzedakah. So now I can't take it. Now I can't take it back. Hava kachal shadate derav mishum da abaye v'amrule mistayech deka mangit akula karcha. Oh, that's the Gemara goes on. So Rava was upset. Rava was upset that, and as Abaye got these heavenly greetings once a week, and Rava got them only on Erev Yom Kippur, and he says, you know, he says, Abaye says to Rava, "Mistayech deka magnit achule karcha." So you should be happy. It's enough that you protect your own city. Right, because of your merit, you're able to protect your whole city. That should be good enough. But let's go back a second. What does it mean when he says, from the minute I thought you took it from me for a worthy cause, I had hesech hadat, which I interpret as meaning like I was mafkir, right? I made it ownerless. I assumed that I no longer had it, and the cost of contributing, even though it was kind of, I was kind of contributing, not with my consent, but retroactively, once I assumed that's what happened, I was glad to do it because it's a great mitzvah, pidyon shvuyim. So this raises the interesting question of inadvertently intending to do a mitzvah, not inadvertently, right? Intending to do a mitzvah which doesn't actually come about. This is not exactly connected to the idea of when something becomes sanctified, right? In other words, an etrog is just an etrog. An etrog has no more kedusha than a lemon until you use it as a mitzvah or until you designate it for mitzvah use. If the former, let's say you buy an etrog, and you lose it, you misplace it, and then afterwards you find it, and you never used it the whole Sukkot for an etrog, so then it was never tashmishe mitzvah, right? It's just a lemon. Or do we say that from the moment you buy your etrog, and after all, the only reason a person buys an etrog today, except for some mishugoyim that like to make that jelly, is to do the mitzvah with. So from the minute you buy the etrog and put it into that funny little case, so you're designating it for mitzvah use until you regardless of when you will actually use it. So this is like connected to tzedakah, right? You know, like in shul, sometimes a guy comes around, you know, like after shul, you know, like to collect tzedakah. So you take 5 shekels out of your pocket, you know, while you're wrapping up your tefillin. And then before you know it, you realize he's gone. He never made it over to your corner of the shul. In other words, you took out this 5 shekel, you intended to give it to tzedakah, but the guy never came over to your row, so you never gave it to him. So what's the status of that 5 shekel?
With the next day.
No, he's not there the next day. He's not there the next day. He was an itinerant beggar.
You guys are regulars.
What?
Well, most of the ones in our show are regulars.
Right.
Do you really have itinerant beggars?
We do. We have guys that show up often from Beitar. You know, Beitar is like a Haredi town, you know, not far away. And sometimes a guy will come in that you've never seen before and he'll say, you know, so-and-so has to have an operation, we're collecting money, whatever it is. You know, it's not necessarily a regular. So the truth is, la halacha, you don't have to give that money to tzedakah. But the poskim will say that it is a recommended righteous practice. As if you had in mind, you had designated this 5 shekel for tzedakah, you should give it for, if you can't find that guy, so then you should put it in the pushka, right? But since you had kind of made a mental commitment to do a mitzvah, you know, should have some kind of binding effect. And if it's not a binding effect, you know, halachically, legally, it might be, you know, ethically, morally. So that's the explanation of the blood letters pledge. He assumed that his rugs were a total loss because they were taken from him. And he assumes that they were taken from him for a good cause. So he was able to rack up that amount of money, the worth of those rugs, which he seems to know very much, very well how much they're worth, to his tzedakah budget. So he says, once I accounted them towards my tzedakah, so then more than that, I don't need. Okay, we'll pause there and we'll come back to this line that I jumped to accidentally next week. And that is all. Sure.